Little Roaring Twenties music to get you in the mood for the first portion of our program today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. The 1920s is considered the golden age of sports for many. And on the show today, we'll talk about some of the decade's finest female athletes and what it took for them to compete. Really pleased to have author Sue Macy with us by phone to talk about her latest book. Book title is Breaking Through: How Female Athletes Shattered Stereotypes in the Roaring Twenties. So, is there a historical female athlete who may have influenced you? What do you think sports do for girls? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Sue Macy, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, right off the bat, the foreword of your new book, it was written by Notre Dame University women's basketball coach Muffet McGraw. And I like that intro, but talk about what she had to say about women's sports.
Well, you know, she's a wonderful proponent for women having, or girls and women having role models who are female. And that's kind of why I wrote this book. When I was growing up, I didn't know that women had played sports throughout American history because nobody wrote about them. And so, you know, Muffet talks about how you instill these personality, you help women develop their personality and their skills by giving them the opportunity to compete and to play together as a team. And all of those characteristics are important for women on the playing field and in the office. Mm-hmm. So I think that sports is a really important building block in women as well as men, and you're seeing that more and more today, where a lot of women in important positions had sports in their background.
Yeah, for sure. I'm thinking about my own 16-year-old daughter who runs cross country and plays soccer on her high school teams.
Wow! Yeah.
And it's such an amazing experience for her and for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know, and. It'll change her. You know, when in my generation, I grew up in the 60s, and there was not that many opportunities to compete in sports, certainly not in school. And actually, the reason goes back to the 1920s, because while it was the best of times for women athletes, it also ended up being a time when there was a backlash about women playing sports. So, and that affected opportunities until the 1970s.
Yeah, so, it did. Yeah. It did indeed. Well, you did say the 20s, though, is considered the golden age of sports. And talk
yes.
about why that is the case.
Well, the 20s was the first time that male and female athletes really became nationally and internationally known heroes. You had Babe Ruth on the men's side. You had Gertrude Ederle swimming the English Channel in 1926 and getting coverage on the front page of the New York Times and many other newspapers. So newspapers were expanding their sports coverage from a sports page to a sports section. And because of that, they were reporting on many more sports and sometimes even on women. So it really opened up sports as a means of entertainment, and you developed a real class of spectators that didn't really exist so much before. You know, people always competed in sports, but now you had spectators who were diehard fans and who wanted to know everything about athletes off the field and on the field, and that culture really started in the 1920s. Also, it's when tabloid newspapers started in the United States, so you had a need to have a story for the back page that was flashing, you know, the news to everyone who could see it. So it was really a great time, especially the beginning of the 20s, when you know, people were having fun. The war was, World War One was over. They were, you know, dancing, drinking,
having a good time.
Yeah, and playing sports.
And they drew the crowds.
Yes,
pretty great.
Yes, in fact, one of the teams I talk about in this book is a British women's soccer team, which they call football, run by the associated with this manufacturing company called the Dick Kerr Manufacturing Company. And that team started as a volunteer team to raise money for World War One veterans who are injured or having a difficult time reentering British life. And they were getting so many spectators that the British Soccer Federation said, wait a minute, more people are going to watch the women than the men. We're going to outlaw women from playing on all of our soccer pitches. So those women ended up coming to the United States and playing a 9-game series against different men's teams.
Yeah.
Right. And they won 3 games. They tied 3 games. And they lost 3 games. So they came over. They wanted to play women, but the game was not advanced enough in the United States that they couldn't find any women's teams that would really be competitive. So they came here and played men.
And to some good crowds.
Yes, they had good crowds and great coverage. New York Times, you know, they played in the northeastern United States, in New England and the middle states. So I went back and looked at some of the coverage, and, you know, they was really on point. They interviewed the stars. And one of the players, Alice Kell, said, "We play for the love of the game, and we are determined to carry on, you know, no matter what the British Soccer Federation did to them."
Well, I kind of thought it was not a great in one way that the Dick Kerr outfit,
yes,
supported them.
Yes. Well, I guess it was in Preston, England, and they had done a lot of wartime manufacturing, I think, so their dedication to helping veterans was important, and they were getting 10,000 or more people a night to their matches.
Yeah, amazingly great number. Well, yeah. That was one of the groups. How did you select the women? I mean, there were a lot of women you could have featured in this book.
Well, I've written about women's sports a lot, and I knew that the 1920s was kind of a turning point. So there were people like the Dick Kerr women that I had never had a chance to write about before. So there were some people I knew about. Other people, I read a lot of newspapers. I especially was interested in the African-American athletes because they weren't really covered in the mainstream press. They were covered in the black newspapers. And I had actually seen a couple of names in my research in the past, and I decided to really try and learn more about them. And there was a tennis and basketball player named Izzy Channels. She was from Chicago, and she was, at the time, African-Americans could not play tennis against the mainstream players. The clubs would not welcome them. So the black tennis players started their own organization, kind of like the Negro Leagues, called the American Tennis Association. And Izzy Channels was the singles champion for 8 years in a row, starting in 1929, and the doubles champion for, I think, 12 years at the same time. So she was amazing. At one point, she had asked Helen Wills, who was the champion white player and Olympic athlete, too. So Izzy Channels invited her, or actually it was another player, Ora Washington, invited Helen Wills to play a match, and Helen Wills said no because she didn't want to be shown up. So there's a whole other history, parallel history of the black athletes going on in the 20s, which I found really interesting, and I was able to unearth some stories that I don't think had been told in books before.
Well, and Helen Wills was connected with the, what was it called, the Battle of the Century?
Oh, yes, against Suzanne Langlin in France. And Suzanne Langlin had been a champion for about a decade. And so she was playing this upstart, Helen Wills. And they only met once, because back then, most tennis stars were amateurs. And after that match, Suzanne went pro, so she was not able to play against the amateur Helen anymore. But they met in France, and Suzanne, who was never nervous, she was uncharacteristically nervous to the point that she had to drink champagne at the changeovers. And she still won. You know, she had the home field advantage. But that also was covered in newspapers as if it was, you know, Babe Ruth hitting his 60th home run. It was amazing how much attention this match got. And people were saying, you know, this is like the sports event, man or women. It was the sports event at the time that garnered everybody's attention. It was in 1926, which was a great year for women's sports.
And it really did a lot for women's sports, did it not?
Yes. Well, you know, it gave people role models at the time, and it started. Even Paul Gallico, who was a sports writer who wrote some awful things about how unappealing female athletes were, even he appreciated these tennis players. So I think that it made people sit up and take notice of the power of women athletes to attract attention. And there was also an issue where someone was going to film this. They had bought the rights to film it. And
paid $100,000 for it, which was a lot of money then.
Yes, and Helen Wills refused to play if only one, you know, if someone made money off of this, because she was an amateur. I mean, people made money because there were tickets involved, but she didn't want somebody to control the broadcasting of this match. So she ended up saying she would not play, and Langlin joined her in that, and the company gave up the attempt to corner the market on the story. So it was amazing. It was a really exciting time, and there were, you know, heroes and villains, and and women who, some of the women are still known today. A lot of them are not, but there are some.
Sue Macy is our guest today. She is the author of many books, a couple of dozen, and the one we're talking with her about today is a National Geographic book. It's called Breaking Through, How Female Athletes Shattered Stereotypes in the Roaring Twenties. Lots of great stories in this book, and some great photography, too, that great photos, which really adds a lot to the book itself. You may have a question for her. What female athletes inspired you? Did you participate in sports as a girl or a young woman? What's it done for your life? Give us a call with your own questions, comments. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Nigel O'Shea, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking today with author Sue Macy about her book, Breaking Through, How Female Athletes Shattered Stereotypes in the Roaring Twenties. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. I'd mentioned photos a minute ago, and I was kind of surprised by the photo from 1876 showing the Vassar baseball team.
Yes.
And they're in long, full skirts. Did they have to play in those long, full skirts?
Well, you know, they were not supposed to be seen by the public. So, yes, they did play in those skirts with, you know, with full skirts and everything. But they used to play behind a field where no one could possibly drive or go by in a horse and buggy or on a horse and see them, because they were not really supposed to be seen playing sports. Back in the 19th century, it was, especially, you know, only in 1870s, it was not seen as acceptable for women to play sports. But yes, that was that was their uniform.
You know, I was just thinking about it. You wondered, do you think athletics inspired women's dress?
Yes.
Do you?
Yeah. Well, especially.
Or maybe the other way around.
Well, I wrote a book about women and the bicycle in the 1890s called Wheels of Change, and the bicycle really was the first thing to get women out of their houses and exercising. And when they would ride bicycles, if they were wearing full skirts, they could get caught in the spokes. And there are stories of women getting terribly injured because of that. So what happened is, they started shortening the skirts, at least to ride the bicycle, and then they some wore bloomers, which was fine when you were riding, but if you walked on the streets, there were articles written about how terrible it was that you were wearing a bifurcated garment. So really, things started changing in the 1890s because of the bicycle. And after that, by the time you get to the 20s, women were wearing shorter skirts, you know, very straight skirts without the crinolines underneath. And so I think sports did have a big impact on that. Gertrude Ederle could not have swum the English Channel, which took her 14 hours, which, by the way, was faster than any man had done it before her.
Yeah.
But if she was wearing the bathing outfits of the early 20th century, which were flannel and went down to your ankles,
she wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, she wouldn't have made it. She ended up wearing a two-piece outfit,
yeah,
that she put together. Yeah, it was with a lot of grease to keep her warm.
The great photo of her with all greased up there in your book. I loved it.
Yeah. I mean, the nice thing about the 1920s is photography was far enough along that you could actually get some action shots, and you could get portraits that were detailed. Because I've been writing, I wrote a couple of books about the 1890s and then the early 20th century, and finally we're at the point. It's not in color yet, but the photographs are very informational, and I like that.
Yeah. Cindy in Boston has a comment for us, I think. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Well, I'm 68 years old now. And I was one of a lucky group of young girls in Racine. We had a gymnastics coach who actually was the boys' coach, but he opened up a class, co-ed, at lunchtime for those of us who were interested in doing gymnastics. And I would say this had a huge impact on my life. And to this day still, I know how to fall.
That's a good skill as you get older.
It's a good skill. I have fallen a number of times, and I've gotten up from all of them, but I think that was mainly because of my gymnastics training. We learned how to do that sort of thing in gymnastics. And like I said, I was lucky for that time period that we had a coach who was willing to take on young women.
So, yeah, that was about 55 years ago. Yeah,
well,
thank you, Cindy.
Well, you know, Racine has a great history of women's sports because of the Racine Belles from the All-American Girls Baseball League, which played in the late 40s and early 50s. I think they ended in 1951.
Yeah. But, you wrote about them as well, did you not?
That was my first book, but I have gone to almost every reunion since 1982. Once I wrote about those women, I could not get them out of my head, and we became friends. They're still, the ones who are around still are the best supporters of all my work. I can give a shout out to Sister Toni Palermo out there in Madison. She's my roommate at the reunions, and she was a ball player.
There we go.
Yeah.
Well, Joe in Blue Mounds has something for us. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Good morning, y'all. I have this question. It's kind of almost a fantasy, but why are there no women playing Major League Baseball? Here's my fantasy. Imagine taking a Major League Baseball scout and sending him to Division I women's softball and finding the three best athletes who play that and drafting them and sending them to the instructional league and turning them into baseball players. I have a hard time believing that there are not, but can't be, women playing baseball. I mean, you don't have to be a huge, powerful person to do that.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. I think it's going to happen because there are several efforts to get to support girls who want to play baseball now. And the Yankees just hired an assistant hitting coach who's a woman. So there was just an article that I read the other day about that. And that has to do a little bit with the assistant general manager, Jean Afterman, is a woman. So once they start hiring women in the front office or as scouts, I think people are going to be more open to giving women other chances. There is a USA women's baseball team now that plays in an international tournament. Japan, I think, tends to be the winner a lot. But there are actually the All-American girls baseball players who are still around are supporting clinics for girls now in baseball. So I don't know if it'll be in the next 5 years, but I bet in the next 10 years you'll see a woman in the major leagues. I think it's going to happen. But it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Joe, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, I was thinking about my next-door neighbor who's a 15-year-old Ava Erlinger, who was a great athlete and was the only girl picked for the All-Star team, Little League Baseball All-Star team. And she was the only girl.
Wow. And you know, you had Monet Davis. I think she was from Philadelphia, who played in the Little League World Series. She was a pitcher.
Yep.
And she ended up playing basketball. Because there are opportunities there for women where there aren't yet in baseball.
Yeah, which is really too bad. Well, you know, I'm thinking about Madison. There were women who weren't happy about sporting women back in the 20s. One was here in Madison, actually.
Trilling. Blanche Trilling, right? Yeah. Yeah, there were women who felt that it was great for girls and women to play sports for the health benefits, but they were worried that women were becoming too competitive and playing for the spectators instead of for themselves. So this movement started by Lou Henry Hoover, who was the head of the Girl Scouts and later became the First Lady when Herbert, her husband, was elected president. They started this organization called the Women's Division of the National Amateur Athletic Federation. And their focus was on stopping intercollegiate and interscholastic competitions for girls and instead substituting these things called play days, where different schools would get together, but teams would be mixed for that day only with girls from different schools playing together on the same team. So there was no diehard chauvinism going on. It was just to play the games. And they were given little presents at the end, like a cup or something, nothing of real value. And they actually ended up being successful, which is why, as I referred to earlier, there were no sports opportunities in school for girls and women between the end of the 20s and Title IX being signed into law in 1972. So I was growing up in this time when there was a glut of school opportunities. YWCA teams, amateur athletic union teams, the historically black colleges supported women's sports almost from the start. The Tuskegee relays had track races for women starting in 1929. So there were some opportunities to play. But as far as schools, you took gym,
yeah.
And you might have had a play day, but you really couldn't compete outside of your own school. So, yeah, that was the impact. And Blanche Trilling was one of the members of the executive committee of that National Amateur Athletic Federation. So
yeah.
She was a leader at the University of Wisconsin in physical education for many years. So.
Here, coming up in maybe 15, 20 minutes, I'll be talking with Jesse Diggins,
who
won the gold medal
in
cross-country skiing. So we've come a long way, and it took a while for women to be included in the Olympics. How they broke into events.
Well, it started slowly. In 1912... was the first year where there were women's swimming events, but the U.S. was under the thumb of James Sullivan, who was on the American Olympic Committee, and he was the head of the Amateur Athletic Union, and he had a prejudice against women in swimsuits. He was aghast that women would show skin. And so the U.S. did not send a women's swimming team to the 1912 Olympics. And because of him, they didn't compete until 1920, by which time he was no longer with us. and the U.S. finally got behind women's swimming and diving and we did very well in those. A 14-year-old girl named Aileen Riggin won the diving medal in 1920, and we won several other swimming and diving medals. But yes, it was slow. Track and field was another area where the first women's races took place in 1928. But after the 800-meter race, which was a half a mile, there was a woman who was injured, but she still ran. And at the end of the race, she fell to the track, which three men who had done the 800 a couple of days before also fell to the track. You go all out for half a mile and you're exhausted. But the newspaper reporters saw this and exaggerated it and made this a cause celebre to try and stop women from running track. They said, they were all writhing on the ground. And the New York Times reporter did this too. And nobody had said anything when it happened to the men. But there was a big brouhaha. The International Olympic Committee thought about cutting all women's track and field races, but in the end they just eliminated the 800. It was not back in the Olympics till 1960.
Isn't that amazing?
For 32 years the longest women could run in the Olympics was 400 meters.
Yeah. And back to James Sullivan for a minute, there's the Sullivan Award, and I think you point out in one of the sidebars of your book
that Sullivan Award. It's for the best amateur athlete in the U.S., and it was started in 1930 in his honor, but from its inception, it's open to women or men. And so far, at least through 2017, 68 men had won and 22 women. But still, a third of them were women. I don't know that he would have been.
He'd be rolling around in his grave.
I know. He was a very proper gentleman, and he couldn't take this the modern age, I guess.
Jeff in Menominee, your turn. Thanks for joining in. What's on your mind?
Well, and I know that you said you didn't have any girl sports until Title IX or something like that, but my dad was graduated from high school in LaPorte City, Iowa, and there was a lot of three-on-three girls basketball played there. And my dad would comment on that they were really good. And the three-on-three basketball played until maybe, I think I saw it on TV, maybe till 15, 20 years ago.
I know that Iowa was always an exception.
Yeah.
I mean, and actually the Midwest always has had a really strong sports culture, but still I don't think that much between schools, maybe within schools or with separate organizations. But yeah, Iowa was the one place where girls basketball shined in school as well as through the organizations. Because I once wrote something about the history of women's basketball, and you know, it's you're right. It's hard to generalize, and I'm from New Jersey, so what happened in New Jersey was not as liberated, I guess, as what was happening in Iowa. Sorry.
Oh man, that's
a good point.
What's the biggest challenge in women's sports today? Do you think?
Well, I think that we're seeing a lot of activity now in terms of equity. And it's not just equal pay, although, you know, I don't think people can argue that the U.S. women's national soccer team does not deserve equal pay with the men.
Yeah.
They win the World Cup over and over. But it's not just that. It's opportunities. It's coverage, it's facilities. You know, the women's team shouldn't have to come in at 5 a.m. when the men's team gets to play right after school is over. So I think that equity and coverage in the media is really an issue. Just like with baseball, I think as more women become sports writers and sports editors, there might be more coverage of women, and the internet has certainly helped because now you can follow your favorite WNBA team by looking at their website. But it's really television, I think, gives like 4% of its time to women. In the past couple of years, studies have shown that horses get more screen time than female athletes.
So that has to change.
Yeah, I mean, people, as you have a daughter, and fathers with daughters are starting to see how important sports can be in girls' lives, and that helps to bring around more people. So the opportunities have really helped to open people's eyes, I think.
Sue, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your book, and I hope a lot of people get a chance to see it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it, Larry.
Sue Macy is author of Breaking Through, How Female Athletes Shattered Stereotypes in the Roaring Twenties. It's a National Geographic book, and really a lot of fun to read. We're going to be turning our attention next to Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Megan Hart. You know, we're talking this 90 minutes about women in sports, and she's with us to tell us about at least a couple of women who will be competing in the Summer Olympics, and they're from Wisconsin. And Megan Hart, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great. It's great to have you stop by here. And we've got a couple of women that we're going to zero in on today. And let's start out by talking about a young woman from Waterford who is going to be competing on the U.S. trap shooting team, Madeline Bruneau.
Yeah, she is one of a couple women we're going to talk about today who really earned her spot at on the Olympic team kind of as an underdog. She finished second at the Olympic trials in Tucson, and it was by far her best finish at a national tournament. So it's really exciting. And actually, the crazy thing about her, she didn't start the sport until she was 16, and she's now 22. So it's a great story.
My dad was a champion trap shooter. And I was pretty good, not nearly as good as he was. But I can tell you, it is a demanding sport.
Yeah, I can't say I have a lot of experience with it, but I did watch it at the last Olympics, and it's a lot of fun to watch as a spectator. And it'll be a lot of fun to see how Maddie does.
Well, she participated in her high school trap shooting team.
Yeah, she did. And now she is a collegiate competitor in Tennessee. And she's actually getting ready to graduate in May, just before the Olympics. And her local paper, the Journal Times, says she plans to become a veterinarian. So she's got a lot going on.
A lot going on. How many teams, high school teams, do we have in the state?
You know, I'm not really sure exactly how many high school trap shooting teams there are. I know that she came to the sport through a 4-H program, so kind of by chance. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily recognized as a major high school sport. So she kind of flew under the radar as a Wisconsin Olympian, but it's very exciting for her.
And what are the projections? Are there any projections for her in terms of the Olympic Games this summer?
You know, I think that it was kind of came as a surprise to a lot of people that she qualified, and I think maybe to a bit to herself included. But I think she's just really, it seems like she's just really happy to compete. And she's actually supposed to compete at a World Cup event this month in India, which maybe would have given some indication as to how she's doing right now with her shooting. But unfortunately, that has been postponed because of coronavirus fears.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, we also have a Wisconsin woman competing in the Olympics as a marathoner, and she has quite the story.
Oh, yeah. Molly Seidel. She is from Brookfield, Wisconsin, and she was a big high school star athlete at University Lake School, a big-time collegiate athlete with 4 NCAA titles at Notre Dame. And then she dealt with some injuries and kind of fell off the radar in 2016, and she ran a half marathon in December in San Antonio that qualified her to run at the Olympic trials in the marathon. And it was her very first marathon ever, and she finished second. And so she is going to the Olympics.
it's just almost hard to believe that running your first marathon and you run it fast enough to qualify for the Olympics.
Yeah, anyone even running a marathon is hard for me to identify with. But what she said after the race that I thought was just so interesting is that it felt like a 26-mile tunnel to her. She was just so focused on how she was feeling, not paying attention to her time. And afterwards, she said she is a racer and not a runner, which I thought was a really eloquent way to put it. You know, she didn't think maybe if it had been a time trial, she would have qualified, but she just knows how to compete. And the Olympic trials were held in Atlanta. It's kind of hilly conditions there. It was pretty cold, pretty windy. And I think because she's such a competitor, that played to her strengths.
No, you know, this whole business, this COVID-19 threat, any possibility of postponing the games, do you think? Or have you heard much about it?
Well, there is a lot of speculation. The Olympics did cancel a media conference that was supposed to start Sunday in L.A., and that has kind of added to the speculation. But last week, the International Olympic Committee met, and the president of the IOC, Thomas Bach, said that he remains confident that the Olympics will go as planned. He said that cancellation wasn't even discussed. Some officials in Tokyo have talked about possibly postponing it. Of course, we've kind of seen across sports how they've been affected by COVID-19. The American Cup was recently held in Milwaukee. That's a gymnastics tournament. And I know they took special precautions to keep athletes safe. And the athletes actually from Russia that were supposed to attend withdrew because of coronavirus. We've also seen Indian Wells, which is one of the big non-major tennis tournaments, was just canceled in California. So it's hard to say exactly what will happen. I worked at the Olympics in 2016 for NBC, and I do have to say it's just such an enormous event. Tokyo has spent an estimated $26 billion on it. So they would not cancel it lightly.
Well, Megan, and we'll be talking with someone who may or may not be, well, she's an she may be Olympics bound, not the one coming up, but the one after Jesse Diggins. So I'll be talking with her next. But
great.
In the meantime, Megan, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to be with us.
Thank you.
Megan Hart, sports reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. Coming up, we're going to hear from another Olympian, a gold medal winner, Jesse Diggins. That next on the Ideas Network.